Here in Orlando, Florida, O-Town Compost is leading the composting revolution, recycling organic waste into a nutrient-rich resource. Join Charlie Pioli, founder of O-Town Compost, as we hear from the nation's leading voices behind the grassroots community composting movement. Welcome to the Community Composting Podcast.
Please rate and review on whichever podcast platform you're listening to. If you feel like this is good content and you're learning a lot about composting.
Hi, welcome to episode number 48 of the Community Composting Podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Alex Thomas of Composting Manufacturing Alliance. And they're one of the, you know, the movers of kind of testing and, you know, figuring out which kind of what products are truly compostable. They're separate from BPI, but I'll let Alex share a little bit more about CMA, Composting Manufacturing Alliance.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Charlie. So like you said, my name is Alex Thomas. I'm our field scientist and our special project coordinator. And I've been working for CMA for just over 4 years now. CMA, the Compost Manufacturing Alliance, is a group of composters and compost owners who came together to establish a better certification process for compostables, knowing that, you know, sometimes there's a dissonance between the lab standards and what can break down in the lab versus what breaks down in reality in the field. And so CMA has been running a field test for the last several years now and running a certification off of that so that they are field verifying the breakdown and the disintegration of compostables, as well as adding the lab component to them.
What kind of products does CMA test?
Yeah, so CMA specializes in post-consumer food serviceware. We'll do research and we'll work with others in other spaces, but we won't certify anything other than what's in food serviceware. And the reason for that is we're really trying to put the emphasis on material that brings in feedstocks to composters. There's value in other things becoming compostable and things like that, but we put emphasis on the food serviceware because, again, we're focused on the composter and what benefits the composter. And so if we have items that are involved with food, we're wanting to try and bring in that food waste to the composter as efficiently as possible.
Would you say that these compostable products are valuable feedstock, or are they just, you know, we just, our composters kind of doing it as a service to, you know, manufacturers and clients, or do they add actually like bulk density, nutrients, you know, porosity, stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a question of a composter's recipe. From the my general standpoint and from a couple of different studies that have been out there, if you assess compostables as a feedstock on their own, there's not necessarily a benefit and there's not necessarily a hindrance as long as it breaks down. So they don't add necessarily a nutrient value. If you're in situations where, let's say, you're carbon limited, and you want to use like a bunch of molded fiber, you want to use a bunch of paper products, you know, then I could see that changing your recipe a little bit, helping your C to N. For the most part, a lot of these, especially the bioplastics and things like that, they're meant to not be a hindrance to the feedstock recipe at all. And they're really more meant to, again, be like the vessel to bring in material.
Right. Can you talk about the different forms of, you know, degradation or breakdown? I listened to a podcast and they talked about, you know, biological degradation versus like stuff that breaks down into like smaller fragments, which is a cause for concern.
Right. Yeah, so one of the things that we try and do is make sure that we're actually achieving breakdown. The lab standard is a good example of that. The ASTM standards do have a decent procedure to catch that. And what we do for our field tests is we do a visual observation and we hand sift through all the material that we're sifting. So if anything, if any small flakes or anything like that, any micro, you know, any visible microplastics, which is kind of an oxymoron, if we look for those. But the two, you know, some of the major pathways that we see and that we're relying on are the same ones that we're looking at for compostable feedstocks and for your typical organics. And so we're either relying on a microbial breakdown or a heat-based breakdown. A lot of times, if you look at basic bioplastics like PLA and things like that, they have a denaturing component at a certain heat, so they start to denature once they get hot enough, and they start to essentially envelop their polylactic chains, and then those can be a lot more easily microbial digested. And then if you look at things like fiber and things like that, we're relying on your heavy chemotrophs to really start to attack the carbon complexes, because it's fiber at the end of the day is still, you know, cellulose and lignin and other things like that. So they're natural products. They just need to be presented in a form that the microbes want to eat them so that they actually disintegrate.
So microbes won't necessarily eat like the more durable PLA compostable plastics.
It depends, you know. So what we see when we have a product fail, which we do have products fail from time to time, in the bioplastic space and in the fiber space, a lot of times, yeah, it's not presented. That's a good way of looking at it. It's not presented in a way that microbial community really wants to break it down or even can break it down. One of the things that we do that's, you know, fairly unique is we run our field test for disintegration, but we run it in all the different technologies that we possibly can within the composting world. So we run a test in aerated static pile. We run a test in windrow. We run a test in covered in-vessel or the GOR type systems. And each one of those systems acts differently, composts differently. It's why they're instituted in different ways and why, you know, operators don't treat them all the same. And they don't treat feedstocks all the same. They still make a good compost product at the end, but how they do so might vary a little bit in terms of residence time or peak temperature or constant moisture, those kinds of things.
Interesting. Yeah, and we use a windrow system here in Orlando. And, you know, I was talking with our operator. He turns it maybe once a week after it comes in and then lets it cure for about 4 weeks, turning it maybe once more during that time. And then we typically don't mess with it after that. It's just stored for a finished product. So, that's interesting because, you know, like I was telling you previously on this call before we hit record, we do a ton of events. And, you know, what I've experienced with these events is people like the caterers, the organizers, they want everything to be compostable. They don't, you know, they don't consider that it's basically like a form of wish cycling. They just want everything to be able to be diverted from the trash, but they don't really understand that the product manufacturers, they, when they're making these products, they never consult with the composter usually. So we're in charge of sending them links online to products that we accept. And cups have been a really big challenge for us, like a cup. The only cup we do accept right now is like a BPI certified fiber cup. As far as cold cups go, I know that I saw on the CMA website that you guys accept in the windrow system, the green stripe clear cold cup that resembles plastic. Have you ever tested that cold cup personally, and what have you seen?
Yeah, so anything on our website has been field tested. We have different categories for each one, like I said, per technology. And there's also two other lists on that website. That one is historical from the data that was ran through the seeded growth system before CMA was fully formed. And then there's another one on there that's called substrate acceptance, which doesn't really apply to bioplastic. It really only applies to fibers or wooden stir sticks, things like that that would kind of be untreated substrate in the first place. But when it comes to bioplastics and cold cups, I've seen a lot of them actually perform very well, and not have an issue. And I've seen some that fail. So if it's on the
Even in a
website, it does work.
Windrow system. Okay.
And one of the things I think, I've noticed, and this is just observational from doing field tests for the last 4 years, is that a lot of times the bioplastics are, like I was saying, they're temperature based. They need to heat up to a certain temperature before they start to denature. Personally, before I even was working for CMA, I would take cold cups from in college. I had a composter that was a modified grain hopper that I worked with, and we would take cold cups in that. But it would heat up enough that we could get them to disintegrate pretty quickly. And
You know those products that say only compostable in a commercial composting facility? So that to me, like people look at, we tell them we can't take these cold cups and they're like, oh, your piles must not like get hot enough. It must, you must not have a commercial composting facility. But I know our piles are reaching like 155 to 160 Fahrenheit. We
Right on
just been
target.
always a little bit hesitant. And then as a composter, you need to be cognizant of the space, because we're hoping to get material in and out within like a 90-day period. So if stuff takes more than that, that might be a reason you're not willing to accept it. Not, even if it does break down. So
Absolutely. And I think, one of the things that CMA stands for and I stand for too is composting and powering their own feedstock, right? Don't take something that is going to cause you more issues than it's worth. And, if something's not breaking down, then that's a, it's you it should be up to you as a composter saying, hey, no, I don't want to work with this. This material is causing me more problems. It's degrading the quality of my finished product. And it's introducing contamination into soil amendment that I want to put on good land.
let me ask your personal opinion then. I mean, we do have a fair amount of space, but do you think we should start accepting these BPI certified products that are on the CMA website that resemble plastic? I mean, people would love that. But we want to be careful because as soon as we open the floodgates, you can't go back on that. So.
There's a couple of models for it out there, and the one that I would recommend is that go with the path that gives you the most control going forward. So, one of the things that CMA does, and we'd be happy to, follow up after this too, is we do create custom lists all the time. So I say that because one of the ways forward could be, let's say you want to try one product off the website. And you want to say, all right, I'm going to use it for this one event. I'm going to run it through my compost. If it doesn't work, there's no way I want to take any more of it. So let's not put that on the list. But then use that as a launching point saying, okay, I've tested so that you can get a database that says, I've tested these ones. I know these products work. I'd be willing to
Yeah.
work with those ones.
I think we do have a call with CMA on Monday, and we're prepared to get some products and give it the old onion bag test. Can you describe the onion bag test for our listeners?
Yeah, so we do a modification on the onion bag test. We call it the mesh bag test because we actually find a lot of times onion bags aren't strong enough for the composting that we're putting these things through. But we do a mesh bag test. So essentially, what that is we're taking in our case, we're using about a 70-gallon bag, filling it full of feedstock in and testing items. Making sure the testing items are completely covered in fresh feedstock. The bag is fully full of fresh feedstock. We're getting things layered, making sure that nothing that we're testing is pushing up against the bag or it's just completely surrounded. And then we put those bags in the compost pile. Usually about trying being about dead center, but obviously there's always preferences, so we're trying to test them as best as possible. Get those covered. And then we'll let them go through either the windrow or we'll let them go through ASP and we'll let them go for their normal residence time. For our ASP, that residence time is usually about 35 to 40 days active phase on a 20-day curing. For InVessel, so that's the GOR type systems, that's about a 46-day residence time and that's all aerated the entire time. And then for our windrow, that's about a 90-day residence time.
So the Gore in vessel, you don't even need to cure.
So technically, no, you don't need to. But our testing partner does have a curing stage, for what they have and what their needs are. But we don't, because one of the things that we've decided as CMA is we really want to emphasize that things break down when they should, and when they should be breaking down is in the active phase. Because sometimes we work with composters who, in between their active phase and their curing phase, are sifting. So if it doesn't break down in the active phase, they're just going to sift it out and now it's trash. And so that kind of
That's
defeats the purpose.
a good point. Yeah, because I visited the Queensboro or the, New York under the Queensboro Bridge compost site where they were using a Gore blanket, but I detract. So how do you find the mesh bag after, you put it through the operations? How do you find it in a giant compost pile?
Yeah, so we use a series of ropes and cones to make sure that we keep track of it. I've gone through a lot of rope in my day. And one of the things that I also do is I make sure to spend time with the operators. I come from an operating background. I worked as an operator in a landfill for 4 or 5 years. I've worked on composting spaces, so I like to jump in a loader. I don't jump in a loader when I'm coming to test folks, but I'll jump up and talk with these guys and say, hey, this is how we're going to approach the pile so that we don't accidentally tear into the bag, or this is how we're going to approach the pile so that, when you go to turn it, don't run the windrow turner straight through it if you've got one or and things like that. So it takes a lot of hands-on training. When we're onboarding a new site, it is we might lose a bag here or there, absolutely, and that just comes with kind of practice as we go along. So the sites that we've been testing with for years, we will lose a bag maybe once a year, So it's got once you get practiced, it gets easier and easier.
Okay, so you recommend tying like a, a high vis rope to maybe the bag, and that way the rope kind of leads a trail to the bag. Okay. Cool.
And one of the things too is, CMA is involved in a couple of work items actually. So ASTM, the American Society for Testing and Manufacturing, which is where the compostable standard is held. So if you look at what's technically defined as compostable nowadays involves the tests set up by ASTM. We're working on two items there that are helping to try and identify a better method for field testing. And so it's something to keep an eye on in that space. And
Yeah,
that'll lay out
because
the whole thing, how to do it.
when I was talking with Gary, my mentor, Gary Bilbro, he talked about, that there would be, that kind of leads to my next question, like how do you fight greenwashing in products that say they're compostable? And do you see any enforcement happening in the near future? I know that's difficult because a lot of these product manufacturers might be in China or a different country, and they'll just spit out a plastic film bag, tint it the color green, and then say it's compostable. So.
Yeah, I think, I think we're seeing more and more legislative approaches to try and address that problem. Washington just passed last year their labeling law where they anything compostable has to have, a green or brown stripe on it. Unfortunately, as part of that, they didn't pass anything that says the things that aren't compostable can't have a green or brown stripe on it. So I think folks are trying to figure it out. I think we're, we do have a lawyer team on our team as well, who's always doing advocacy for trying to get the best actions enacted so that we can do these things more enforceably. I think the FTC green guides are good. They're updated, every 10 years. I was hoping they're kind of hope they might increase the frequency that they update those as we get along here. But there are some tools out there. I think, we're coming to a place where some states are going to be right on top of it and some states are going to be behind it. So I think it'll be interesting moving forward.
We're in Florida. We're always the laggers in the group.
Yeah, I come from Wisconsin, so we've been lagging a little bit on the policy side for things like this as well. But even looking to the neighbors from where I'm at, Michigan's got some pieces of legislation that they've considered in the past. Minnesota's got a big bill that they're working on right now, all targeting, how to better address compostables and how to better address, food waste in general. But usually, compostables are part of that conversation.
Yeah, that's great. And I think my personal opinion is composting is like the highest form of food waste recycling. It turns food back into a nutrient-rich soil amendment, which can be used to grow more food. But what do you think about some of these forms of food waste recycling, like depackaging plants? And the most recent one I've come across is the Harp digester out of Ireland. There's a Four Seasons hotel down in Fort Lauderdale here in Florida. They we're uniquely familiar with them because they've invited some people on our team to go look at it. They use it for all their trash. They throw everything in it. The majority of that trash is food waste. But it spits out this end product that is filled with microplastics, glass, metal even. And then they sift that end product. And then what they get is like even smaller plastics and contaminants inside the fertilizer or the soil amendment. But it is microbial. It has a lot of microbes in it. I just don't see what I just don't understand, like why anyone would like it's great for reducing the volume of your trash, but it still goes to the landfill anyway, so.
I have a lot of mixed feelings about because there's a lot of systems out there. There's I think more than I count, and I think there's more coming online all the time. And I think one of the biggest things for me is, what are these machines actually doing with the food waste? To replicate a composting system on a tabletop in 5 hours is a really, 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 really difficult challenge. And quite frankly, I don't know if it's actually physically possible to do that, right? Because when we
I
think about
haven't
the
seen.
composting cycle, right, we're going through the whole nitrogen cycle, we're changing the phosphate, we're changing all of this organic material into a stable soil amendment, a nice, beautiful, rich topsoil. That takes time. You can't just do it like that, no matter what microbes you throw at it, right? That takes a series of progression. It takes a whole plethora of communities, not just one, not just two, but if you look at some of the literature of progression of microbial communities through a compost pile, you know, to me, it's almost like art, right? You know, you can see the transition. You know, you've got your mesophile starting to balance pH, and then after the pH is balanced, well, then the thermophiles are happy, so they start taking off. Then your temperatures go off. Now you've got this beautiful hot pile, it's steaming. Now you've got your actinomycetes developing. You've got your different fungal communities that will show up in pockets, and then they'll start to drop off, and then the fungal communities will take off, and you know that's where you'll get your mushrooms and stuff like that growing in your pile, which aren't a bad thing. They're nice to have. You know, they're breaking your stuff down. And to try and replicate that on a benchtop and to call it compost is really something that does disturb me a lot. If you're calling it compost, I just straight out, I disagree. You know, Dr. Sally Brown, you know, wrote a good article in BioCycle last month about the difference between a digestate or a dehydrator and even a composter. And at no point did she say any of these that are on your countertop or any of these that could even be in, you know, in your back kitchen are a composter.
Mm-hmm. I read that article by her, and it was mainly concerning the loamy and the mill technologies that, you know, have been on the scene for like less than a year now. But the HARP digester is just like a bigger one of those, a 24-hour mm-hmm. process. It spits out fertilizer, and I know some community composters, one in particular, who has invested in this technology, and you know, the fertilizer, they've gotten it tested a bunch, and it does have a lot of microbes in it, which is great. But as far as like the pH and the nutritional value, it doesn't prove to like offer. You know, it's not great for germination or even fertilization of plants. So the only use I see for it is like reducing the volume. And then, you know, you got to keep it clean, like, because if it's contaminated, it just is filled with microplastics. And then you apply it to land, it's just applying like a bad product to land that's filled with microplastics. So,
I would completely agree. I think, you know, again, I'm not to bash any of them, as long as they're not calling it compost at the end of the day. But it, even in those situations where there's not really a system that you can say throw everything in here and you'll get compost or you'll get a decent fertilizer at the end. That system, to my eyes, doesn't exist yet. And if you can, that's not to say it doesn't have uses. Like if you have a clean feedstock and you do need to reduce your volume and that's the way you want to go with it, awesome. Yeah. You know, I think pulpers, I worked in the food cafeteria for a while. Food pulpers do just fine too. You know, we compost that stuff, no problem. And it dewaters it and makes it easier to handle anyway.
Oh yeah, I have seen those pulpers, but yeah, those people just need to remember, like, you know, that then it goes to compost. If it goes into the trash, then it's not really offering a lot. So,
as you start to take on more food scraps, you realize very quickly that you need a better composting system to process the material. This is why I highly recommend the aerated static pile micro bin designed and made easy by O2 Compost. In 60 days, I have finished compost without putting in the labor of turning the pile. The piles heat up to over 140 degrees, killing pathogens, weed seeds, and fly larvae, making the end product safe to use in the garden. With 32 plus years of experience in the compost industry, Peter Moon, owner of O2 Compost, is a leading expert in the field of ASP composting. I encourage you to set up a free half an hour consultation with Peter Moon by going to his website, www.o2compost.com. That's the letter O, the number 2, compost.com. If you mention that you heard about O2 Compost on this podcast, you'll receive a 10% discount on the purchase of the Microbin Compost Training Program.
One of my remaining questions is like a soil sample test. Do you have any recommendations for good affordable soil sample test? Because I know it runs the gamut.
Yeah, it can. And each lab does it differently, you know. I am a proposal or a proponent of SGA testing. You know, I think I think we've done our first generation of SGA testing. I think it tells us some good information. I think we can change the test hopefully over time to be more reflective and be more, actually, I would love to see a more discerning test, so we can
What
tell
do you
the
mean by
differences.
that?
Well, so right now the test is based on maturity, on plant growth and heavy metals, and then, you know, and the typical feedstock values. But it treats it, there's, if you do that from my, you know, use of it so far, and I want to, this is just talking, you know, hypothetically and wanting to dive further, but I don't see a ton of discernment between a product that comes from ASP versus a product that comes from Windrow versus a product that comes from Gore versus a product that comes from a community scale composter. And even from Windrow, like, I don't see a difference between a pile that sits static for 45 days, gets turned once, and then sits for another 45 days versus a product that turns every week. But each of those products are wildly different, because they're different. And even just from a standpoint of, you know, different feedstocks create different products. Well, how can we get a test that better discerns that and says, no, this is good, this has a higher MPK, or this, you know, has those kinds of values. But it's still, like I said, it's still a very good test, get some basic data and to really get assessment of maturity, like I said, and to get the plant ecotoxicity data is helpful. I think for other tests, you know, if you're looking for soil tests, if you're looking for a soil test for land that you're applying to, there's a bunch that you can do, you know, respirometry, there's bulk density, there's pH, there's all, and even just creating a soil profile will tell you a lot about the soil.
Do you recommend any labs to like send it into?
Yeah, I mean, I use Soil Test Lab out of Moses Lake. They're on the USCC website. Really enjoy working with them. They're pretty affordable as well. And
Soil
then,
test lab.
yep. But there, and but I would also, you know, say, you know, look at what's around too. A lot of times, a lot. If you look at even universities, right, there's a lot more soil university programs out there than there are composting programs, but they can run the same tests. And so, you know, and closer to you, I was talking with UGA, the University of Georgia. We've got a new materials institute and a soils department. Both have the capability to run some really nice and informative tests on nitrogen cycling, or even if, I mean, it's not a cheap test, but even if you wanted to, they can do DNA extractions and things like that. Or, you know, as an example from where I'm at too, you know, I'm in central Wisconsin, and we've got the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point here, who's got a whole water and environmental analysis lab that will test your soil for very, very little fee. And even, you know, they do a soil awareness and soil health day, and they have members of the community come from all over to test their soil for free and, you know, get
Oh, cool.
basic soil test
Yeah,
parameters.
we've sent our compost to IFES, the University of Florida Agriculture Extension School, and pretty much it gave us like a very, you know, the key metrics we're looking for, but I think the general consensus among like composters is that it's not very accurate. And I don't know why. So I would like to kind of compare maybe like the soil lab test results to IFES. But if you're looking for affordability, IFES is the way to go. So.
I find, you know, a lot of times universities are good partners when it comes to this type of stuff. There are, you know, there are commercial labs out there too. I think like I said, USCC's got a whole list of them online.
And for any composters looking to make their compost like organic certified or OMRI, I believe.
OMRI.
Yeah. So, you can include any serviceware or liners or anything like that, correct?
Yeah. Right now, you can't include any of that. I'm pretty sure I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure you can't even take biosolids. There's a lot of stuff that you can't work with in order to have an OMRI certified product. And that's one of the things I think the industry is trying to change. But right now, as it stands, yep, you can't. And I think you can't really have any post-consumer at all, just from the contamination risk.
Oh, wow. Okay. And then my other question is actually about biosolids. Like biosolids, could you talk a little bit about the definition of biosolids? Because I always thought it was kind of like from wastewater treatment plants. You know, there's a lot of, most of it is liquid form, but then there's the solid form. Mm-hmm. It could be like human waste. It could be like the stuff that goes down your kitchen drain. And then, you know, basically that has to go somewhere. And some wastewater treatment plants, like in my hometown of Portland, Oregon, they have a anaerobic digester there to catch the, you know, the energy portion. But mm-hmm. even after that, it has to go somewhere. And usually in the United States, it goes to the landfill. And I've been in the landfill before where loads of biosolids would come in and it was not pleasant smelling. But could you talk a little bit about biosolids and like with the, how is the composting industry viewing that? What is the future of composting biosolids?
Yeah. So biosolids are just like anything else. There's a bunch of different kinds of them, but the most common one is what you were just talking about, which is wastewater municipal wastewater treatment plant waste. So they do aerobic digestion of all of the liquid waste as it comes in. You've got screeners that come in, take off most of the trash, if not all of the trash that they're trying to get through. Then they run it through, for those who haven't been to a wastewater treatment plant, they're very similar to composting. We've got this whole aerobic phase right up front that they're doing, and they're super oxygenating the system, letting it run for a certain residence time, and then relying on microbes to break down the organic load of that material so that they can have, in this case, clean water at the end. That's what they're aiming for. But if you take like a wastewater treatment course, that's kind of one of the big things that they're doing is relying on microbes to take the biological, what they call it is a biological oxygen demand and a chemical oxygen demand. So historically in the wastewater treatment plant, by a water's capability to hold oxygen is one of the things that they use for, is this water clean or not? So if I take a bottle of water and it's got a bunch of muck and mud and stuff in it, and it's got 10% oxygen in it, and then I check on it, you know, 5 hours or to a day later, and now it's got 1% oxygen in it, well, that's not clean water. There's a lot going on there. There's a big organic load and there's microbes breaking it down and consuming that oxygen. And so, like I said, when all this wastewater comes in, gets aerated, it gets treated by microbial digestion. Then it gets. Then what they do is they run it through a clarifier. They've got clean water on top that goes one way that gets treated with antimicrobials, usually either UV or chlorine, depending on the facility. And then the solids settle out to the bottom, and then they get treated as well in a different way. And that's your biosolids. A lot of times, depending on where you are, if you're in a community of a decent size, your wastewater treatment plant probably has exactly what you're talking about, an anaerobic digester of some kind. So they'll take that clarified solids, they'll run it through a digester, get methane production off of it, and they still have a digestate at the end. And then, that they not all facilities have that. Most do of a decent size, just because it is really actually been a success in waste management, the case of wastewater treatment plants, because a lot of them, once they start to institute, one anaerobic digester, even two, they're 90, percent powered by their own waste. So they have a huge electrical off-output by doing that. I mean, generating their own electricity. And so, but then what they do with that solids is up to each state's regulations, each community regulations. And so after that stuff's been digested anaerobically, that's where it can get land. Usually what happens is, in a lot of cases, either that might get land applied if it's the right season and you're in a state that can actually land apply biosolids, it might get land applied and just go straight to a soil. Otherwise, it goes through a dewatering process, forms these big cakes and mats, and that would go to the landfill. Or in some cases, that material go to a composter. And there are composters out there that have had the relationships with their sewer districts and with their wastewater treatment plants that they've been composting biosolids for 10, 20 years now. And there's a lot of research into it. It can be really done. So, part of the reason not only work when we're working with feedstock, feed weight or food waste, but when we're working with feedstock of any kind, we have all of our PFRPs, our performance-based, pathogen reduction pathways, right? We have to meet those with biosolids too. It's already gone through a certain amount of disintegration and wastewater treatment. Like it should be relatively pathogen free, but as a composter, we want to make sure that we do our due diligence too. And you can make a really rich product off of it. So a lot of composters that I've worked with who work with biosolids will make a good product out of it. It's super rich. It's very dark, very organic because we're getting a
And
lot
it
of
can be
organic matter.
used to grow food. It's not just for like landscaping and ornamentals.
Yep, you can use it to grow food, assuming that you've met your disease reduction pathways. And then a lot of times, using Wisconsin as an example, right? They have a different classification system based on how you treat your biosolids. So you've got a biosolid class B or C or A, and A is the only one in Wisconsin that's cleared to be used for food. But that means that it's been treated in the right way, and composting is one of the methods that you can treat a biosolid and say, nope, it's good to go. It's stable. It's disease, it's disease free. You can go ahead and put that on food and be fine.
That's really interesting. And what are the other areas biosolids can be generated from besides wastewater, municipal wastewater treatment?
Yeah, so municipal wastewater treatment is a big one. There are also biosolids from just anaerobic digesters in general. So anaerobic digesters are used outside of the wastewater treatment plants as well. The big one from that is like dairy farms are a good example, or even just hog farms, more so dairy farms, where you can take all this really liquidy cow manure, dairy manure, run it through a digester and do the same thing. Now you've got methane production off of it, but you still have a digest aid at the end that needs to be treated and can't be used just as is. And so either, there's a lot of different ways to do that, but some that material can get composted. Sometimes farmers dewater it and then send that water to a waste treatment plant, and the solids they can use as bedding because it's nice and soft and fluffy, but it makes good compost too. Some of the other biosolids are like, for again, where I come from, we're in paper making country. So the paper making process can have biosolids a part of it. That stuff is a little bit different. In Wisconsin right now, paper mill residuals are classified as a hazardous substance. And so they have to be landfilled. Those are some of the stinkiest stuff I've come across. They can get
Really,
rank.
from like paper pulp, pulpers, yeah.
Well, even from paper mills
Paper
specifically,
mills, yeah.
and this is always post-treated stuff. So it's the concentrate of all of that paper sludge over, a couple of days of operation and a couple of weeks of operation. And
Oh, wow.
if you can. Depends on the state that you're in. I'm on a project right now that's assessing whether, you know, there are certain applications where we can actually compost that material. Because the reason why some of the states, including Wisconsin, have it listed as a hazardous substance or a not acceptable compost feedstock is because historically that material has contained a lot of heavy metals and other things like that. A lot of those have been phased out of our paper mill process. And so a lot of this material now is just pretty heavy carbon material. I think we're carbon to nitrogen ratio of, you know, 70 to 100 to 150. It's high. And so it can be used as a compostable feedstock potentially. And like I said, I'm working on a study right now that'll hopefully help us say, no, in certain cases, if it meets these parameters, we can use it as a feedstock, right? We don't have heavy metals. We don't have any other contaminants. It's just carbon.
Yeah. There's just like a lot of organic byproducts out there that, you know, we hate to see go to the landfill when it could have a, you know, a higher use. I know biosolids has been in the news a lot lately about potential PFAS. You know, where do you think that's a detriment to composting biosolids?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a big hesitancy that I would look at for your state regulations. So, you know, one of the things right now, and again, coming from a waste management standpoint, we as composters don't generate PFAS. Landfills don't generate PFAS. It's biosolids and wastewater treatment plants, they don't generate PFAS. But because they're collection points and because this material ends up there, you know, a lot of them are being held responsible for as if they were generators. And that apply, and like I said, that applies to composters. So that's where control over your feedstock is a big thing. Because if you do take in biosolids, there's a chance that you could be taking in PFAS with that, depending on the type of system that you're taking it from.
And where is PFAS generated? Typically with the product manufacturer, like, you know, you think of the nonstick pans, I've heard, is like a big concern for PFAS, like kind of the chemical they use for making the pan nonstick. You think of like fast food service where it kind of has like that waxy coating on it. Could that be a PFAS, you know, holder, I guess is the right word.
Yeah. And so there, you know, that type of food grade material has had PFAS in it in the past. We're trying to phase that out. I think a lot of folks, you look at a lot of manufacturers and they're starting to do that. But that has been a source in the past. Obviously, yeah, Teflon and other, you know, other nonstick substances have been sources. Two of the other big ones are firefighting foam. So firefighting foam has PFAS and PFOS in it. So, and you know, and that's, if you look at where that is, you know, that's one where you're doing major firefighting. But where you need commercial grade firefighting foam, actually one of our sources that we've found that is a big, you know, big kind of plume of it is around airports, because they use it on airports, you know, so that they can quench a fire very quickly. But one of the things that gives the foam its structure, it does rely on a PFAS chain. And so that's been a source of it. And chrome also has been sources of the chroming process. And I'm not sure the full pathway, but if you look at chrome wastewater, it does have a level of PFAS in it as well.
Interesting. It's very, very concerning. But thank you so much, Alex. This has been a great discussion, and we're looking forward to receiving those products from CMA and putting them to the test. And I think it would make a lot of our clients happy if we were to, you know, expand our acceptable list. But yeah, we do have to be careful about that and, you know, overall just do what's best for the end product, the compost. So thanks for taking time out of your Saturday morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I hope you have a good conversation with the rest of the CMA team. They're a really good team in a couple of weeks here. And then I'm sure part of that, CMA is working on a community test standard. And one of the things that we have started to work with community composters all over is testing products at the community composting scale. And so if down the road that's something that you want to do, I'm sure we'd be happy to help facilitate given our years of testing experience. We've been doing this for a while. We're here to help the industry. So.
Definitely. Oh, thanks again. Have a great rest of the day.
All right. Great to meet you, Charlie.
Bye-bye.
If you enjoy the Community Composting podcast and want to support future episodes, please follow the link in the episode show notes to give a small monthly recurring donation, even if it's $5 to $10 a month. We'll continue to come out with killer content to keep the grassroots movement rolling.